Are we supposed to take care of our hygienic needs in front of our spouse? Are wives supposed to walk around a bedroom completely naked?
Sure.
Absolutely.
I guess it depends on your body type, but you know.
And swim naked.
Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein. Thanks so much for tuning in.
First, tips for staying valued in the workplace as we grow older.
Wait till you hear what Elvis Presley wrote to President Nixon, an eclectic collection of little-known correspondence.
Then, using technology to preempt relationship violence.
Plus, love or lust. Why not both? What keeps a relationship together? The answers just might surprise you.
And shooting the breeze about some super-sized fish tanks.
Nearly 80 million baby boomers have either reached or are about to reach traditional retirement age. Many, however, would like to remain in the workforce longer than their predecessors. These seasoned employees want to continue to bring in an income and stay valued and engaged.
As an attorney and former president and CFO of one of the largest engineering and IT staffing firms in the United States, Cash Nickerson has emerged as a thought leader on the American workplace. He is the author of Boomerangs, Engaging the Aging Workforce in America, and joins us from Dallas. Welcome, Cash.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be with you.
Why are you calling us boomers boomerangs? Are we making a comeback? What's going on?
That's a very good question, and there's actually two meanings to it. One is there is a returning and a desire to return to the workforce if you left or to stay in the workforce if you're in it in ways that we haven't seen before. People are staying and graying in the workforce. The other aspect to it is the real change in the shape of sort of human lifespan, right? It used to be when you, let's say not too long ago, you would live, work, retire, die. And so, that looked like a triangle, that cliff of retirement. And now you imagine people who are looking to span their work life and match it to their natural life. And the natural life is more like a boomerang because now the aging cycle is sort of like the growing up cycle. And so it's got really those two meanings, the boomerang.
Okay, well, of course, you know, we boomers are the largest generation in history. So what potential impact does this huge retiring workforce like us boomers have on companies, Cash?
For companies, it's actually a disaster, especially in certain areas. The generation behind us, Gen X, only has 48 million in it. And so there's going to be a talent drain if we don't solve this problem of how to keep people in the workplace longer, how to accommodate in the workplace. If you look at specific areas, disciplines like aerospace and defense, there will be a massive shortage of engineers, and we're starting to see the beginning of this. If you look at the major aerospace companies and defense contractors, half of their engineers are eligible for retirement.
Oh, that's scary.
Wow, that is scary. And Cash, in your book, you hit the Age Discrimination Act like head on and say it needs a major overhaul to really address the aging workforce. And you also say, and as you just previously mentioned, that there is a gray tsunami approaching. And because it's moving so slowly, we're not preparing for it. So what can we do? And how do you see the act rewritten?
The act was passed in the civil rights era. And civil rights are generally about something that doesn't change. You're African American or you're white, you're male or you're female. These are all things that are like on-off switches. And so you say, don't discriminate based on somebody being African-American or somebody being male or female. This act, Age Discrimination and Employment Act, passed in 1967, was passed in that era. And so all you had was an on-off switch, young, old, before 40, after 40. After 40, you can't discriminate based on age. Well, we know that age is a process. We know that it makes sense to be able to talk about something like age at a certain point. And those kinds of conversations are off limits. The kind of conversation you and I are having about age, you can't have in the workplace. You think it would make sense to be able to go to somebody at a certain point and say, listen, Jill, you're going to be 65 you could retire, or how would you like to go halftime for the next 5 years and mentor one of the millennial employees so that you can pass on the institutional knowledge of our organization? And then maybe after that 5 years, maybe go to quarter time. You see, that just seems to make a lot of sense, but it is illegal. And because it's illegal, those kinds of conversations aren't happening, and so we're not able to develop kind of a deceleration. You climb the corporate ladder, why not have a descension of the corporate ladder? The rule says, the law says, well, you know, you can't do it based on age, so you'd have to offer it to everybody. Well, if you offered halftime work to everybody, the millennials would take you up on it immediately.
Sure.
Well, Cash, is there any progress in overhauling this act?
No, because it's like I said, it's sort of like getting somebody to focus on a piece of ice melting. It's just not that interesting, and it's happening so slowly, and we know it's coming. I mean, the math is already built in. You can't create any more Gen Xers. I think it will become more of a crisis as we get closer to social services running out of money, or at least being jeopardized. And that looks like about 2030 right now, where the social services just won't be able to support the retirees. And if I give you some data, you'll say, that now that scares me. That doesn't sound like a piece of ice melting. Imagine that when Social Security was passed in 1937, there were 157 workers for each potential beneficiary. Okay, by 2030, that number is 2 to 1.
Wow. That's really high.
Yeah, and so it will hurt social services, it will hurt corporations, and, you know, it'll hurt the boomers themselves because they don't want to be put out to pasture. And so the win-win-win is to solve this problem because companies need the expertise, governments can't afford the social services, and people who are productively engaged, like the three of us, are healthier, live longer, are happier. And so it's a real win-win-win if we can get people to focus on it, which is why I wrote the book in the first place.
Our guest is Cash Nickerson, author of Boomerangs, Engaging the Aging Workforce in America. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or iHeartRadio.com. Now back to our conversation with Cash Nickerson about strategies for landing the job and staying longer in the workforce. Cash, not to play devil's advocate here, but I'm going to. Older workers, you know, they can become diminished, you know, both mentally and physically, especially if you stay in the workforce, you know, in your 60s and into their 70s, and some people stay even into the 80s. And, of course, this applies to both blue-collar and white-collar workers. So how would you counsel an employer to prepare for older employees without being discriminatory?
It's a good question. And step one is to get to know the demographics of your workforce. Most companies don't know what demographics they have in their workforce. And so that's step one, is to realize, you know, so you don't wake up one day with half your employees eligible for retirement and critical skill sets. So get to know your workforce from a demographics perspective. Again, maybe people are afraid to even know about it because they're worried about being accused of discrimination, but you need to get to know it. Another example is, look, we are more careful in the workplace, those of us who are older, but when we get hurt, it's more serious. You can imagine the difference between a 60-year-old falling and an 18-year-old falling. And so I have something, I recently wrote an article about elder-proofing the workplace. Do you remember when you had children and you had to get down on your hands and knees and pretend you were a child to sort of childproof your home? The same kind of thing in the workplace is to realize what specific challenges there may be. That's very good for the company and very good for the worker. Ergonomics. I joke about this, and I've had a few companies that have already done it. I mean, imagine sitting in a meeting, and it happens all the time, and someone hands out paper and the print's really small. Okay, well, there's no reading glasses just in that conference room. You know, looking at the workforce from the older workers' perspective, maybe putting together a focus group of some of those workers makes a lot of sense. But if you look at it, I think the number of workers in the workforce has gone up by 50% in the last 10 years. So it's like 21% of the workforce is now people over 50. That's up from 14%. So it's something that you need to take seriously. And those are some ideas. Get an ergonomic study done. Look at potential risks to your aging workforce. Get to know the demographics of your workforce. Accommodate them. I ran into a situation where we had an employee who was upset, and they were out of bereavement leave. You know, young people take time off for weddings. As you age, unfortunately, you need time off for funerals, and bereavement leave is generally fairly restrictive. So it's just a matter of looking at it from the perspective of the boomers and those who are aging.
Another one I could add to that is hearing, because as people age, your hearing starts to go. So not only larger print on perhaps your work papers.
Hand out magnifying glasses and microphones.
That's right.
I can just see it now.
Well, you've definitely got the idea.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny because one of the worst things we do all day is sit, right? And so I actually have a dual construct so I can sit or stand. And I've had it several companies, clients who have said, hey, that's something that's really working for us because people whose backs hurt, they're better off stretching every hour or so. But it's all sorts of creative things, and you got to work with the people who have the knee pain.
Exactly. All right, so let's segue a little bit and talk about some of your best strategies for boomers seeking jobs, how they can really stay competitive, especially against, say, a younger applicant, and maybe perhaps some tips once they've actually landed the job. So first, Cash, the resume. An older worker, they've been in the workforce for maybe 40 years. Do they need to document it all?
That's really a good question, and it's just hard to look at some resumes from people who are older, and it's 10 pages long, and it just sends a message. You know, your resume should look like a young person's resume, except that you don't have to mention that you were in Spanish club to show that you have some outside interests, you know? I mean, young people have a hard time filling a page. Take a look at someone's resume right out of school. You know, they're assistant treasurer of the Spanish club.
Well, maybe you could put in that you're part of the swing dance club.
Yeah, I would avoid.
I'm not sure I'd put that in either.
I think you should avoid allusions to bingo and to square dancing.
Okay, okay. Well, Barbara, take this off your resume.
Burst my bubble.
Or even Keno.
Okay. Or Mahjong, maybe,
yes,
too.
Or Mahjong, that's right.
Okay, so we need to look young, but we need
yes.
to look really experienced.
Yes.
Okay.
But
exactly.
Then, Cash, are you saying we should put our most recent jobs on there? And how recent is recent?
I think, like, accomplishments are what's important in skills. You know, because if I'm looking at hiring you, I want to know what problems you can solve, what challenges you can meet, what training you have, that hit the ground running, that experience can come through by saying, look, I worked at such and such a place, and this is what I was responsible for, and this is what I accomplished. And if you want to talk to, you know, and here's my references. Hopefully they're still alive.
Yeah, really? Maybe get the references in writing as you move on.
Maybe get it taped.
Exactly.
Okay. Well, Cash, then you say that we should be aware of our energy level. Okay, well, I'm aware, and it's not real high. So what do you mean by that?
You guys both come across, you ladies, as having tremendous energy and happiness and excitement about life. People hire people like that. They can tell it on the phone. They can feel it. They can sense it. When we talk on the phone generally with our other older friends, we think we sound fine. So you actually need to let a young person interview you. And I have to just digress real quickly. I had somebody who was interviewing for a job with Red Bull, and I was coaching them, and they were just like, yeah, fine. I said, listen, nobody at Red Bull is going to be interested in anybody who doesn't have energy. You're going to have to find the energy within or interview with someone else, maybe Geritol.
Or have a few Red Bulls.
Have some Red Bulls before the interview.
Exactly. Yeah. So you have to almost artificially up your game because we just sort of, our energy dies down over time because we're dealing a lot with people our own age, and you just have to find the youth within you because it's there. But like I said, it doesn't have to be artificial. All the studies show that if you speak with energy, if you smile, you actually are healthier, and you'll be healthier. So that positive outlook, positive attitude, positive energy, and the gym helps too.
Another one you talk about, which is really interesting, is really being aware of your attitude towards those younger. In other words, we might be interviewed by someone who's maybe our son or daughter's age, right?
Yes, and this is extremely important. I hear about this from young people. They can feel it. And there was a really good article, Harvard Business Review article called Transference, which said basically you bring your home life into the workplace. If you fight with your sister, you're going to fight with your female colleagues, those kinds of things. And so just imagine that you've been a parent. And when you look at someone who's in their 20s, you think child. You think kid. You think irresponsible. Of course, it doesn't help that they're on Facebook all day in the workplace, and every time you walk by, they quickly try to hit the mouse to show they're focusing on their work. But those attitudes, yes, you will be working for someone younger than you, potentially. I remember when I was at Union Pacific Railroad, 25 years old, everybody was twice my age. Now I'm amazed. I walk into a room and there's all these young people in the room.
How did that happen?
How did that happen?
Well, Cash Nickerson, author of Boomerangs, Engaging the Aging Workforce in America, this has been most informative and very fun. Thanks so much for sharing your great advice with the two Boomer Babes.
Well, thank you. It was a real pleasure. And I'm going to have to develop my own theme song. I heard yours and I love it.
Great.
These days, social media and texting dominate human communication. So it's surprising that a blog called Letters of Note by Sean Usher is so popular. It takes us back to the unrivaled charm of old-fashioned correspondence. So, Kathy, when was the last time you wrote a letter instead of an email?
Actually, just a couple of weeks ago, Barbara.
Oh, she's a show-off. I expected her to say 5 years
yeah,
from
really.
Now.
Some of the most compelling letters from the blog are featured in Sean's latest work by the same name. Sean Usher joins us on the phone from England. Welcome to Two Boomer Babes, Sean.
Thank you for having me.
How did you come up with the idea to feature these letters? I mean, why are they so compelling?
Well, if we go back 12 years, when I first met the lady who is now my wife, it was literally 2 weeks after we started dating. She moved to Spain for a year with her university course. So, you'd think that was the worst possible way to start a relationship. But we spent 10 months, conversing and falling in love through letters. We wrote to each other quite a lot for that first year. And it was the best possible start we could have had, I think, because we learned about each other so much. And in such depth, in a way that we wouldn't have done had we not been apart, writing to each other. It was at that point that it really clicked for me, the power of correspondence and its importance. And then 5 years ago, I was working in a job I didn't like. And to get some inspiration, I started looking into famous letters with a view to writing an article for a client. But I went to the local library and got out these dusty old books full of letters by people like Mark Twain and Charles Dickens, the masters of letter writing. And I was instantly hooked, and I spent days and days just engrossed in all these amazing letters and started a website. Couldn't believe that a website didn't exist, of its kind already. And it took off really quickly because it's such a simple idea and it appeals to everyone because there's letters on the website for every different occasion. It's an emotional roller coaster. And they're all, these letters are self-contained kind of stories. They're time capsules. It's first-hand accounts of amazing situations and events throughout history. And then a few years ago, I decided to compile a book containing 125 of my favorites. And it's done extremely well, and I couldn't be happier.
So, Sean, if you had to pick your favorite, the one that amazed you the most, which one would it be?
That's like choosing a favorite child. But I do, at the minute, my favorite is a letter written by a man called Robert Pirosh, who at the time, back in the 50s, was a copywriter in the US, but he wanted to become a screenwriter. So he wrote this standard form letter to all the Hollywood producers, directors, and studios that he could find addresses for. And it's an amazing, amazing letter. And it got him an interview with quite a few studios, one of which was MGM. And he went to work for them. And then a few years after starting with MGM, he won an Oscar for one of his scripts for a film containing the Marx Brothers called Battleground. It's just the most amazing, perfectly formed letter in which he lists all his favorite words, these beautiful, beautiful words. It's a pleasure to read this letter. And then he ends by saying, I've just returned from a trip in New York, and I still like words. May I have a few with you? It's the most delightful letter.
Oh, I
so
love
that's my
it.
Favorite at the minute. It shifts, but my favorite changes all the time.
All of them were just incredible, but there were a few that really stood out for us. And one of them was the letter from Annie Oakley, you know, of course, the star performer with Buffalo Bill Cody's Touring Wild West show, to President McKinley back in 1898. Can you give us a bit of background? Can you tell us about that letter and just give us some of the behind the scenes that was going on at the time?
Yeah, so this was in 1898, in the April, and it was the Spanish-American War was looming on the horizon. So Annie Oakley, on this beautiful, beautiful letterhead, on which there's an illustration of Annie Oakley herself, surrounded by all this kind of ornate text and little illustrations, she offered her services, and she offered her services to the U.S. president at the time, William McKinley, and she offered to supply him with an army of 50 female sharpshooters to deal with the war. But she didn't even get a response. So she was, I imagine she was quite gutted, but it's a beautiful, it's just a beautiful artifact. I mean, it's handwritten as well, which makes it all the more precious. But yeah, unfortunately her offer wasn't taken up.
And what do you think this revealed about Annie Oakley, the person? I mean, she seemed very patriotic.
She did very, very patriotic. And in fact, I think a few years later, she did the same thing again. And she offered her services. She offered an army of female sharpshooters again to the president. And still he didn't take her up on the offer. So she was clearly very, very patriotic. And she didn't take the silence as an offense. She was really keen to kind of to dig in.
We're talking to Sean Usher, author of a popular blog and book called Letters of Note, turning the spotlight on old-fashioned correspondence. Sean, there is also another very interesting but yet very bizarre letter from Elvis Presley to President Nixon. Tell us about that one.
Well, this is one of my favorites. It goes without saying, really. It's very, very strange. Elvis Presley, he was, not many people realize, he was obsessed with police badges, and he used to collect them. And he wanted to collect all the police badges in the U.S., one from each police force. And there was one that he couldn't get hold of, and it was a badge from the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Now, the only way he could think of getting hold of one of these badges, these quite rare badges, was to write a letter. Well, in fact, first, he got on a flight to Washington, to the White House, and while he was in midair on the plane, he handwrote on this American Airlines stationery a letter to Nixon in which he offered his services as a federal agent at large, purely so he could get one of these badges. It's an amazing, amazing letter. He personally delivered the letter to the White House when he arrived in Washington, and he did, in fact, engineer a meeting with Nixon. You probably know the photographs. So that, you know, they're the most requested photographs in the history of the National Archives in the U.S. The picture of Elvis standing next to Nixon in the Oval Office, and they're the result of this letter. It's an amazing, amazing story, and it's the strangest, the strangest kind of artifact. But it was successful. He got the badge.
And didn't he offer to bring Nixon a present or two?
Yes, he gifted Nixon with a pistol. He gave him a Colt 45 pistol. In return for this badge, which makes the whole incident even more, you know, alluring.
So do you think Elvis actually wore all these badges, or he couldn't possibly wear them all?
I don't think he wore them, no. At this time in his life, I think he was slightly, eccentric. I think he just kept them in his house. I don't really know the specifics of that, but I can't imagine him wearing that many badges. Who knows, maybe he tried.
So, Sean, we have to ask you about this final one. The letter from Amelia Earhart, who, of course, was the first woman to fly solo across the Atlantic, on the morning of her wedding to George Putnam. It was a most unusual letter. Can you give us a bit of background and tell us about the letter?
Yeah, so George Putnam was her publicist as well as her fiancé. So they worked together very closely. And he proposed to Amelia Earhart lots and lots of times before she finally said yes. I think she just gave in the end and said yes to him. And then on the morning of the wedding, as you mentioned, she wrote this letter to him and essentially said to him that she was very reluctant to get married and that they don't have to be faithful to each other. She was basically setting out a stall and saying, let's not put too much on this marriage because there's every chance that we could kind of get bored with each other. And she was very ahead of her time. She was a very, very strong letter for her to write. It's an amazing thing.
And they actually got married, right?
Yeah, they got married. And then obviously then a year after the letter was written, she disappeared over the Pacific Ocean. So a tragic ending to the story.
Sean Usher, author of Letters of Note, an eclectic collection of correspondence deserving of a wider audience. This has been so interesting. Thanks so much for sharing with the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you very much.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Up next, combating relationship violence through technology. Stay with us.
Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. Every day I wake up at 5 to give Dad his medicine. At 6, I make his breakfast. At 7, I shower. Every day I wake up
at 5. For those caring for a loved one, we hear you. That's why AARP created a community to help us better care for ourselves and the ones we love. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
We recently spoke with Sharon Love, whose 22-year-old daughter, Yardley, was killed by her ex-boyfriend 4 years ago. Since that time, Sharon has worked tirelessly through her One Love Foundation to spread awareness about relationship violence, particularly on college campuses.
Dr. Jackie Campbell is a domestic violence expert at Johns Hopkins School of Nursing and a member of the National Advisory Board for the One Love Foundation. She contributed her years of research to help develop a free app available on smartphones to combat relationship violence through education and technology. She joins us on the phone from Baltimore. Welcome to the program, Dr. Campbell.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be with you.
Dr. Campbell, how prevalent is relationship violence on campus?
Unfortunately, we find that it depends on whether it's a self-report survey or actual reports to the police or to campus authorities. But from women themselves, we find that somewhere around 20% of all college women have been assaulted, and that could be either physically assaulted or forced into sex by a boyfriend or ex-boyfriend.
Wow, that's pretty staggering. Why are young female college students particularly vulnerable?
In many ways, they are not. Those are the kinds of numbers that we get from national surveys of all women of that age. So it's not just young women on college that are at risk for relationship violence. But women on college campuses, sometimes because they are in a dormitory situation, they are not as much in contact with their family, and because they're meeting a whole host of new people where it's sometimes hard to immediately determine who might be an abusive kind of a partner, in some ways, you know, there is if not increased risk, at least the same kind of risk that we get for young women that are all over the country in other circumstances.
Okay, doctor. So let's talk about the One Love My Plan app that you helped develop. Can you tell us how it works?
Well, this is a very exciting app, and I want to give tribute to my colleague, Dr. Nancy Glass, who also developed much of the safety planning that's part of it. The danger assessment piece that's also part of it is what I actually developed myself. So we worked together on the MyPlan app. And what it does, and it's meant for not only young women, but also for friends or family members who might be concerned about a young woman. If they're in a relationship where there is violence, the app, first of all, helps them recognize what's happening to them as relationship violence.
And how does it do that?
Well, it goes through a series of questions about the relationship that inquires about what might be happening in terms of not only physical hitting, but also, as I mentioned, the forced sex and or a continually controlling, harassing, stalking kinds of behaviors, internet kinds of stalking. So it helps her recognize the relationship as abusive and then helps her make some judgments about how dangerous this abusive partner is. And then based on that level of danger that there is, plus her priorities in life, you know, what she wants to do next, what her priorities are in terms of this relationship. Does she want to try and keep it but make it nonviolent, or does she want to get out of it? Then it guides her through some safety planning and also helps her be in touch with resources like the National Dating Violence Hotline, which has text capabilities and email chat rooms, those kinds of things that she can be a part of, as well as being helped to find local domestic violence resources, both in the city or town where she is, but also what's available on campus
okay.
to help her.
Well, say a girl feels like she's in danger. I guess she could call 911, but could this app, could she talk with somebody 24/7 and maybe they could call the police if she feels like her life is in danger?
Yes, absolutely. And that's part of it. This National Dating Violence Hotline number is 24/7. She can talk to them, and the app helps her get there. The app definitely says if you are in immediate danger right now, do call 911. That's exactly what you should do. But if you're just trying to gauge whether or not this particular person is dangerous to you, the app can help you do that. And even if there's not considerable danger from this person, if there is relationship violence going on, then it will help her get some help to address that.
And then we understand that one of the features of this app is that it's password protected. Why is that important?
Well, absolutely. And part of it is that the app cover itself is very innocuous looking. It doesn't have something to do with dating violence, because one of the things we find is that these controlling dating partners will oftentimes go through the young woman's phone, try and find out who she's been texting, what apps does she have, what are they about. So it's password protected so that somebody like that can't get into it. And it's also recommended to young women, especially if it is a dangerous abuser, after she works through the safety planning and takes down the numbers and gets in contact with the helping agencies, that she actually take it off her phone. She can always get it again. It's free. If she wants to go through it again or go through it with a friend, but the very safest thing would be to keep it off her phone entirely.
And how is this app helpful for friends and family members?
It walks a friend or family member through the same questions so that they can see, okay, is this a relationship I should be worried about? My girlfriend's been seeing this guy or can be a same-sex partner. And for whatever reasons, it makes me uneasy, some of the things she says. So she can either go through it with her friend, which is obviously the most useful, but she can do it without her friend first to see, okay, are some of my concerns warranted? Is this something, you know, I should be worried about? Is this something I should be talking to her about? So, you know, it helps a friend or family member be able to either confirm or, oh, okay, you know, I shouldn't be worried.
Okay, well, finally, doctor, really quickly, where can one find the app in order to download it on their smartphone?
It's in any app store, both Android and iTunes. All of the app stores have it under MyPlan. You can also go to One Love Foundation, and it's joinonelove.org. There, website also, you can download it from there for free, all of those places.
Dr. Jackie Campbell, domestic violence expert and one of the developers of the One Love My Plan app, thanks so much for sharing this important information with the Two Boomer Babes.
My pleasure.
According to the National Opinion Research Center, about 1 in 5 married couples are in sexless marriages. The stats are even worse for those in long-term relationships, 1 in every 3. So what's going on? Is the loss of passion inevitable as the years go by, or is the problem deeper?
Our next guest, Shmuley Boteach, an Orthodox rabbi, prolific author, and frequent guest on Oprah, says the glue of a healthy marriage is surprisingly lust, not love. In his latest book, Kosher Lust, Rabbi Boteach shares how to tap into his principles of lust to keep couples romantically involved and the flames burning in the family hearth. He joins us on the phone. Welcome to the show, Rabbi.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, I got to start out by asking you, how did you, an Orthodox rabbi, get into the relationship counseling business, especially about topics like sex and lust? I mean, I wouldn't have put those three together.
Well, isn't that what rabbis do? What rabbis do is they give people advice and guidance about every area of life, and the most intimate area of life is the most important. The fact is that when young people, either of marriageable age or teenagers, want to find out about sex, where should they go? To Hugh Hefner or to more wholesome, more spiritual sources?
Well, I guess you're right, but a rabbi wouldn't have been my first thought, actually. But after this conversation, I'm sure it will be.
Well, this book in 1999, thank God, went on to be an international bestseller, and people then raised their eyebrows, a book called Kosher Sex. But the fact is that it's sold to Jew and non-Jew alike. I think it's real spiritual and wholesome perspective, philosophy of sexuality. And the purpose of this book is to strengthen that by going beyond kosher sex, which focused on sexual practices that lead to intimacy, and focus now on how we recreate desire and lust.
So it is lust and not love. That's your premise. But boy, that really bursts my bubble. So what do you mean? Tell us about that.
Relationship experts can give us all the advice they want about recreating romance or desire in a relationship. They can tell us go to a hotel room, go on some romantic vacation, but if you have no desire to implement any of those things, then it's just a waste of time. Our most important sexual organ is not our genitalia. It's our brain. It's our mind. It's where desire rests. Now, there's rules how to stay fit. There's rules how to succeed in business. There's rules how to be a good student. There are rules of desire, and this book elucidates the 3 rules of lust, which are, without elaborating on them yet, unavailability, number 1, mystery, number 2, and sinfulness, number 3. And what happens in marriages is that marriage begins to lose those 3 ingredients. And as it loses those 3 ingredients, desire, lust, and attraction wanes. And I'm out to recreate those 3 things.
Well, Rabbi, I mean, you hear so much about sexless marriages these days, you know? And, I mean, is that a relative new phenomenon, or did they just not talk about it generations ago?
Well, you know, isn't that amazing that we think that we're this over-sexed society where sex kind of seeps into the culture, television, movies? But the truth is that it seems to be present everywhere except in the American bedroom.
Yeah.
The statistics vary, but between 1 out of 3 and 1 out of 5 American marriages is sexless. That's astonishing. We're not talking about people, you know, who are 100 years old. We're talking about people in their 20s, 30s, 40s who've lost interest in sex. Even more interesting, I think, for a lot of people is the fact that the sexlessness often starts with the husband. You know, we have this perception that men are just like sexually crazed animals who can never stop. On the contrary, women are much more sexual than men. They love sex with their husbands, and a lot of them are not getting it. I counsel so many couples that sit on my couch, and I see the mascara just running down the face of the wife who begins to describe in humiliating detail what it's like to get into a bed with a man on a nightly basis who won't touch you, who won't lay a finger on you. And you feel ugly, you feel discarded, you feel superfluous. And it cuts to the core of a woman's femininity. If a man doesn't want to make love to you, if you get naked in bed with a man and he kind of watches television or plays video games or falls asleep, it's an insult. And women are feeling that rejection. And it's really hurting them. And that's why, aside from all the other important reasons, we have to recreate desire, because the institution of marriage is not catering right now fully to what women want. I argue in the book that what a woman wants is to be desired, to be chosen. It's that the twin ingredients of of choice, which is primacy and exclusivity, to be the one and the only. A woman wants to be her husband's one and only. So even if he, you know, he's not cheating, he's not looking at porn, but he just doesn't want you, or he loves you, but he doesn't lust after you. He talks of you in terms like best, you know, something we hear constantly, best friend. What is a best friend? This is an intimate relationship. You're not buddies. You don't just watch the game. I mean, you can also be buddies, but that's not the primary characteristic of the relationship. You're not there to watch the game and belch together. You're not there to go fishing together. You're there to be lovers. And when that aspect of the relationship is lost, the entire relationship is diminished.
Do you think that this might possibly be why so many women gravitate to, you know, series like 50 Shades of Grey?
That's exactly what I say in the book, that 50 Shades of Grey captured a moment in history, a moment in modern times, where women were unashamedly and unabashedly saying, we want more lust. Notice that 50 Shades of Grey is not a Harlequin romance novel. It's not about some great romantic novel and the guy buys flowers and he's so poetry. And Christian Grey is the exact opposite. Christian Grey is hard-nosed, hard-edged, very sexual, and he's interested in sex more than a relationship and love. And women were reading this. Isn't that fascinating? Because we would think that that would be a man's approach to relationships, that women would not want to read a book like that, that the guys would want to read a book like that. And yet, 50 Shades of Grey sold to women. And we kind of defeminize women when we say they're not interested in lust. You know, let's stop playing this strange game in our culture, this Madonna whore culture, where a woman is either the Madonna, and she's above lust, and she's above sexuality, and, you know, she's just virtuous, or she's a whore. Both are degrading stereotypes. Women are very complex, like men. And when it comes to sexuality, they want the same kind of excitement and passion that men want.
Right. Well, you know what, Rabbi, this all sounds great. And I think I'm speaking for men and especially for women, because I'm a woman. But, you know, realistically, it seems that a lot of us are just plain old tired. I mean, with all the demands of work and the kids and maybe, you know, for boomers, we're taking care of our aging parents. And, you know, there's so many things that we're dealing with. I mean, we're lucky if we have time to breathe at the end of the day, let alone, you know, light the candles for a passion-filled night with our husband. Do you think of that's playing into this whole thing?
I don't disagree with that at all. But notice that no matter how tired people are, if they're having an affair, guess what? They're raring to go. You know, the same people who say I'm too tired for sex or, you know, I'm overscheduled, you'd be amazed that once they start having an illicit affair, and I wrote a book called Kosher Adultery that studies affairs, they make time, they carve time out of their schedule, they get all pumped and primed and the adrenaline rush. So I think it's just an excuse. In the final analysis, we live in a free country, and people do what they want to do. And if you want to watch television for 3 hours a night, because that is what excites you, then that's what you're going to do. If you want to make passionate love because that's what excites you, that's what you're going to do. But to say that the lustful part of my marriage on the back burner because I have no time for it is another way of saying, you know, I'm not really interested in it.
We're speaking with Rabbi Shmuley Boteach about the importance of lust in a successful marriage and how to keep it alive and strong. His new book is called Kosher Lust. Rabbi, how would you counsel couples in a long-term relationship that have simply become, say, bored with one another? They just don't want to do it anymore.
Well, isn't that true of most people? It's the boredom that begins to really affect the relationship. I would counsel them to buy my book, meaning it's supposed to be a little bit humorous, but not totally devoid from the truth, which is that this book studies the three ingredients of desire, unavailability, mystery, and sinfulness. And marriage, as it progresses, loses those three essential ideas. Unavailability, marriage is about constant availability. Sex on tap, you know, people in the same bed and they're married and have sex, but when there's no pursuit and there's no obstruction, and when you don't have to surmount hurdles and obstacles, it's not as exciting. Secondly, marriage loses its mystery. Our marriages are way too open. I mean, you need to think about it. Are we supposed to take care of our hygienic needs in front of our spouse? Are wives supposed to walk around a bedroom completely naked?
Sure. Absolutely.
Well, you know,
heck,
yeah.
Why not?
I guess it depends on your body type, but, you know.
And swim naked.
Well, that's, you see, if you swim naked, it's supposed to be erotic. But what you don't want is to swim naked and it's like, and your husband is reading the newspaper. I mean, isn't the body supposed to elicit some erotic response?
Sometimes.
Sure. I mean, 24/7, I don't know, but sure, of course.
I don't believe in 24/7, but it should elicit an erotic response.
Exactly.
Okay, so Rabbi, how do you do that? How do you elicit this erotic response? How do you put the spark back into the marriage?
First and foremost, you go back to the fundamentals, which is focus on desire. The desire is created by the twin energies of masculine and feminine, the polar opposites of masculine and feminine, where friendship is secondary. The shared values and shared experience of friendship is actually secondary to the deep differences that exist between the sexes. We have to sometimes highlight those differences. And here's the example of like unavailability. In a Jewish marriage for 3,000 years, we practice a period of sexual abstention every single month. And a lot of people find this very outdated, that, you know, why, if you're married, we should just have sex whenever we want. Because truth is, it leads to a loss of desire. Everyone knows that absence makes the heart grow fonder. Lust is increased specifically through distance, believe it or not, whereas love is magnified specifically through closeness, proximity, and intimacy. I don't believe we're supposed to morph into being the same person when we're married. I don't believe that we're supposed to lose all our individuality as we just become part of a larger whole.
So, Rabbi, are you saying you should limit sex to 2 weeks in a month? Is that what you're saying?
Well, people can find what works for them, but I think that distance and obstacles in a relationship sometimes maintain this deep erotic desire. Take, for example, in an affair. Why is it that affairs are so erotic? Because you don't always have the person available to you. And you're therefore, there's like a 10-to-1 ratio of fantasy about the person versus what you actually have. So you're always mentally anticipating what you're going to have, unlike in marriage, where there isn't mental anticipation. Whatever you want, you just get.
Rabbi Shmuley Boteach, author of Kosher Lust, great conversation. Thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes.
Thank you for having me.
Back when we were kids, our lucky goldfish lived in a small glass bowl with rocks from the garden and an artificial plant. But like everything else in America, these days fish tanks are supersized. Our next guest and his team have taken aquariums to a whole new level as they create extreme fish habitats. These Florida-based aquarium specialists are part of a company called Living Color Aquariums, and their high-pressure job is captured on National Geographic Wild's popular television series, Fish Tank Kings.
Jose Blanco is the aquarium production manager and joins us to talk about these massive underwater creations and what it's like to literally work with a cast of thousands of fish, that is. Welcome, Jose.
Thanks for having me on the air.
So how did you get involved in this extreme aquarium building business?
I actually started because I had a degree in art, and I had experience working with some of the materials that we work with, and I had done some architectural molding. So when I joined the company, it was really as a mold maker and artist, and as I grew with the company, I moved into my current role as a production manager and also work with our design team. I honestly didn't even know, 15 years ago that there was even an industry and the size of this industry and how big it is and how involved it can be.
Well, tell us, who are these customers of yours? You know, why do they want these extreme fish tanks that you build?
Our customers range from big commercial projects, hotels, restaurants, that kind of stuff, and then residential clients that we get. Really, I think it's people that really love aquariums, or when they were younger, they had aquariums. Some of these projects are also in museums and seaquariums, so those are obvious reasons. But I think for the most part, is people really do find that these aquariums have sort of a very calming effect.
Well, Jose, what's the largest private tank you've built?
The largest private tank has to be 5,000-gallon, what we call a raceway tank here in Miami for a client.
If you're going to compare that to a swimming pool, how big of a swimming pool would that be?
It's about a third of a swimming pool. If you figure an average-sized swimming pool can be anywhere from 10 to maybe 15,000 gallons. You imagine this tank is 5,000 gallons, you could easily swim in it. You could fit several adults in there.
Jose, we also understand that you have some very unusual requests sometimes. And that a customer wanted his 1970 Mini Volkswagen bus turned into an aquarium. Could that be?
That is true. He did. He has a car dealership, and he was also an aquarium enthusiast. And he really wanted something unique, and he got it. He had an old VW minibus. So essentially, it was a real engineering challenge for the guys in our team who do the LSS, which is the life support systems, the actual filtrations and pumps that create the environment for the fish. And just as a design challenge for our team that makes all the inserts and all the decorations, because of the space restrictions, access, it has to be maintained. So that was a real challenge because we literally had to transform that VW bus into something where you could access the aquarium for maintenance purposes and also just for putting all the equipment. In the end, it was fantastic, and there it sits at his dealership.
And you couldn't drive the bus, right?
No, we had to remove the engine, and we had to reinforce it to carry the weight. There was a lot of engineering just to carry the weight. So it's really essentially a really cool cabinet for the aquarium.
And we understand that your tanks really are quite a biological feat. Can you tell us what goes into actually putting together one of these extreme tanks?
Of course. Obviously, the scale of our tanks. For us, the average size, I would say, we're looking at probably 1,000 gallons. So the filtration system has to be, you know, scaled up for that volume of water. So really what you need to do is create a biological system in the water. You can't. It's not just salt water. There's actual bacteria and biological matter that needs to be created in order for the water to sustain life.
And what kind of fish are in these tanks? I mean, are we talking sharks? Are we talking little goldfish? What's in these tanks?
We get a whole range of requests for fish in terms of the different fish. But when you're looking at making aquarium, our marine biologists will create what we call a fish portfolio. And again, depending on the scale, you want fish that are going to be bottom dwellers. You want fish that are going to swim towards the middle. And then you kind of want fish, you know, that like to hang out on the top layers of the water in order to get, you know, a lot of activity.
Jose Blanco, extreme aquarium specialist and star of National Geographic's Wild's Fish Tank Kings. This has been great fun. Thanks so much for sharing your stories with the Two Boomer Babes.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the air. It was a pleasure talking to you both.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zymer Communications.
Who might you save?
Your mother, your father, your husband, uncle, and son.
Learn FAST, F-A-S-T, the sudden signs of a stroke, and you could save
your friend, your best friend, teacher, boss, coach.
F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. F-A-S-T, face, arm, speech, time. That's F, face drooping, A, arm weakness, S, speech difficulty, T, time to call 911. The sooner they get to the hospital, the sooner they'll get treatment. And that can make a remarkable difference in the recovery of
your neighbor, the waiter, a fellow shopper, a total stranger, grandmother, grandfather.
So learn FAST, the sudden signs of a stroke, then pass it on, because you never know who might save you.
Your wife, your colleague, teammate, mother.
Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
This Father's Day at Lowe's, score free gifts for the greatest dad. Right now, get a free select DeWalt, Craftsman, or Kobalt tool with purchase of a select battery kit. Plus, get a free Werner 2-foot aluminum ladder when you buy an 8-foot fiberglass ladder. Shop these deals and more this Father's Day at Lowe's. We help, you save. Valid through 6/15 while supplies last. Selection varies by location.